This is Backstory, the show that looks at the present through the lens of the past. I'm Peter Onuf, the 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th century history guy. Today on the show, it's all about presidential transitions in American history. Which ones matter? Which ones don't? And why do they loom so large in the story that we tell about our past?
We've got another phone call. It's Patrick on the line from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Patrick, welcome to Backstory.
Hey, how are you?
What are you thinking about the presidential transition question?
When posed the question, the first thing I thought of was a presidential transition through tragedy. And most Americans, wow, the only knowledge they have of anything like that would be the transition from Kennedy to Johnson. But right. Unfortunately, there's a long history of that.
A lot of people felt that Johnson to Nixon was a tragedy, Patrick. I know that's not what you really mean.
Termination.
And more specifically, how such an event has maybe been a catalyst for the entire realignment of a political platform or just the objectives of the administration at the time.
Yeah. Well, I'll jump in on that, Patrick, and say that Lyndon Johnson was probably the most influential president domestically since Franklin D. Roosevelt. He capitalized on the nation's mourning for John F. Kennedy. And in my own personal opinion, he accomplished much more than John F. Kennedy ever could have had Kennedy live. Now, that's not just because of the tragedy of Kennedy being shot, but that certainly served as a catalyst. I'm really eager to hear what my colleagues say about early 19th and late 19th century transitions.
Unexpected transitions we're getting at here. Mm-hmm. Would be really tragic for the Whigs when William Henry Harrison just died after a month.
Whigs, Peter, you know, 20th century guy asks, what is something I wear on my head?
This was the great, 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 great conservative party of the pre-Civil War period. Conservative in those days didn't mean what it means now. Conservative meant willingness to use the state to achieve great things. Anyway, the Whig moment came with Harrison's election, but he contracted pneumonia, supposedly because he got a cold at the inauguration. So that was a mistaken transition. He shouldn't have gone out that
day. So what happened?
Well, then John Tyler of Virginia, who was balancing the ticket, tip a canoe and Tyler too. Tyler turns out to be what you'd expect from Virginia in those days, an unreconstructed, deep down inside, old Republican kind of guy, states' rights, Southerner, slaveholder, and so much for the Whig program.
And Peter, when was all this happening?
That would be in my century.
The 19th century. that would be 1840.
Yeah. Now, Ed, I think we would all agree that you have the granddaddy of tragic transitions of them all,
yes.
Right?
I was letting the game come to me.
I know. Well, I just bounced the ball off my foot to you.
Well, you know, it's just really hard to imagine the importance of Abraham Lincoln's assassination in 1865. And Andrew Johnson comes in, not unlike Tyler under Harrison, to balance the ticket. Not somebody with great sympathy for what Abraham Lincoln had been doing, but in fact a former Democrat, a Tennessean, a Southerner. And he finds himself in a very ambiguous situation because Lincoln had not said with any clarity at all what he would do about Reconstruction, about the freed people, about the vote for right. former slaves. Mm-hmm. So the nation is in agony. You've just lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives. People want the war to be over. And Andrew Johnson, ironically, says, no, we've got to be sure that we, you know, punish the slaveholders at the same time that we don't give anything to the former slaves. And so in just about every possible way, Johnson made things worse. But all that said, a very interesting quote from an Oxford historian, Richard Carbadine, who is here giving a talk, and somebody asked him, what would have happened if Abraham Lincoln had not been assassinated?
Conveying the usual assumption that things would have been better in some way, you know, that if Johnson hadn't been there to mess things up, that somehow we would have avoided the agony of Reconstruction and its aftermath. And Richard Carbadine said, no, it wouldn't have been any different. In fact, it could have been worse, because if you didn't have a Congress opposed to Andrew Johnson in the White House, making sure that the gains of the Civil War were written into the Constitution in the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing due process of law in the first hand and the right to vote in the second. You would never have had this instantiated in the Constitution, and there would not have been a foundation for the Civil Rights Movement 100 years later.
That's a great point.
So it's not unlike Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy, Brian.
Yeah.
And I think what all this shows is that never has there been an assassination that's followed by just a sort of a direct line, you know, just a sort of a playing out of what the president who was killed would have done, it seems to me.
So, Patrick, you asked a question, and we ended up asking about 10 questions in return. How are you doing out there?
Pretty good. Really insightful. Like what you guys have to say.
Thanks very much for calling, Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick.
Good talking with you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Presidential transitions, revolutionary or not, they do help us all mark the passage of time. But for some, the changes hit especially close to home. I'm referring to the employees of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Like other political appointees, they serve at the pleasure of the president. But customarily, the butlers, gardeners, and waiters remain on the job even after their boss moves out. Henry Holler is just that kind of guy. For 21 years, he presided over the White House kitchen as executive chef, preparing breakfast, lunch, and dinner for every president from Johnson to Reagan. And we have him on the phone today to see if we can't get him to dish out a little information about his former bosses. Henry Holler, thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to have you with us, Mr. Holler.
So, Mr. Holler, was it hard to adjust to each of these new presidents as they came in? Or did they have to adjust to you?
Oh, no. I definitely had to adjust to them. You would be surprised that all the presidents, they were watching their diet a little bit, you know. Like President Nixon, after 1 week, he said, please, no more first course. Then a week later, they said, please, no more dessert.
I hope you didn't have to take a pay cut for that, Mr. Holler.
No way. No.
So did they drink wine with dinner?
When they had guests. Mm. But otherwise, not very often. Mm. Not very often.
So what would you do if they asked for something you didn't know how to cook?
Oh, come on. He knew how to cook everything.
Did you know how to cook everything?
Well, my forte, I mean, I'm born in Switzerland. My background is really very much French cuisine.
Right.
The Reagans, Mrs. Reagan was fond of Italian cuisine, like piccata of veal and osso buco and saltimbocca, you know, things like that. I was there almost 22 years, and in that time I served pretty well my whole repertoire. You know?
Mr. Holler, we don't want you to make invidious distinctions, but who did you enjoy working for most?
Oh, they were all nice.
Oh, stop it!
This is why he lasted so long. Okay, here's a question, Mr. Holler.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not going to tell you that.
But would you be willing to generalize about Republican tastes in food and Democratic tastes in food? Go out on the limb, Mr. Holler. Your pension is secure. I think.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. No, this is like this. When the Democrats were at the White House, they were always more busy. The Democrats invited everybody, you know, the truck drivers and the...
Really? So they really were men of the people and women
of
the people?
There was more, the parties were bigger, no question about it.
Okay, so that was more work for you, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes.
So the ultimate question is, how much did you like to work?
Oh, I mean, didn't make any difference. I never looked at it that way, you know.
It just shows that the Democrats like big government, though. They're bringing all those people in for free meals.
That's right.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, probably.
No free lunch.
Well, Mr. Holler, you have made us all hungry. And my colleagues and I are going right out for Big Mac.
We only get one course.
We only get one course at best. But I want to thank you for joining us and sharing some
Thanks
of your memories with us. Thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Washington came first and he was perfect. John Adams kept us out of war with France. Jefferson made a Louisiana Purchase. In 1812 James Madison kicked the British in the pants. James Monroe told Europe they could suck it. John Quincy Adams looked just like his dad. Andrew Jackson got rid of all the Indians. Van Buren served one term, but it wasn't bad.
Well, guys, look, we started out the show today by questioning this tendency, the structure of history around the March of Presidents, to make too much about presidential transitions. But look at us. Here we are trying to pry gossip out of a White House chef. I mean, we've become presidential historians, feeling that history turns on every little tidbit of information about the president, that somehow this is going to shape the course of American history.
Brian, you're right. We are modeling the very behavior that we're supposed to be critiquing.
Let us not cast the first stone.
But think about it. I mean, you just can't help but notice that the books that people buy about the American presidencies are all fundamentally biographies, one form or another,
right?
And you can't help but notice that on the morning talk shows that the people who are called presidential historians are fundamentally biographers.
Right?
It's the, sort of the same thing. So we think of the presidency and of American history, therefore, is like a soap opera. It's like a series of set pieces.
It's a chain of biographies. You could say it's something like the genealogy of monarchies. You go from one to the other, and everybody memorizes these, and we do the same thing.
So is this monarchy envy?
I don't know. I think it's Days of Our Lives envy.
Soap opera monarchy.
So wait a second, guys. I never thought I would defend the March of Presidents, but you've provoked me into it.
Are you
telling me the presidents don't matter?
I'm not saying that the presidency doesn't matter.
Okay, good.
I am saying that the presidency is embedded in history rather than the other way around.
Right.
Okay? Let me tell you a perfect example of that. Abraham Lincoln. Now think about this. He was plucked out of semi-obscurity. He was just a lawyer, a railroad lawyer, in an unhappy marriage in a relatively unpromising political state of Illinois. They're much more prominent Republicans.
He wasn't even good-looking until he got a beard.
Yeah, well, and there's some debate about even that sartorial choice. But we look back on it now, and it seems so unlikely that he would become the greatest president in American history. Nothing that you would have thought about genetics, education, about grooming, anything would have suggested. And matter of fact, would he have been great in anything other than the context of the greatest challenge the American people have ever faced? So on the other hand, I'm willing to believe that, say, to use one of Brian's favorites, Herbert Hoover had all of the tools to be the best American president.
He was super.
Right?
Great engineer. He was a rock star.
Yeah. And just so happened to live through this Great Depression, not of his own making or not even of his nation's own making, and yet now he's the byword for incompetence.
I agree. And so really the operational question ought to be, who is the guy we're talking about? And to answer it, we don't recreate the life. Instead, we reconstruct the context, that is, the world within which our subject is operating. That's another approach, an anti-biographical approach to biography.
I'm going to ask a rhetorical question now, which means, Peter, don't actually answer it.
Right. I got it.
So here's the question.
Yeah.
So what's so wrong? Why does it matter if we take this biographical approach to the March of Presidents as the story of American history? And here's the answer. It creates expectations that no one can fulfill.
Right.
Right.
That gets back to
this,
our,
this idea that if we can just find the right person that – and we can keep saying he. It's funny. I'm always editing myself.
But we're historians.
It's always been a he up to
this
point.
We're historians.
Can – somehow write things. And that's why we're perpetually disappointed with whoever we elect president.
So, guys, I have a simple question. Why, if none of us believe that fundamentally this is what really matters, why aren't we talking about the imbalance between the global financial system and the overall international regulatory structure?
Well, I'll tell you what.
That's what really matters.
I have an answer for you.
Whether it's Obama or McCain,
I have an answer for you.
Okay.
And it's the human need for stories. And it is what we are looking for is some kind of stability and security in a world of flux and contingency.
Yes.
And that takes the human form and face of our subjects.
Increasingly, as we talk in the show, I realize that there's one stretch of American history that belies most of the generalizations that we make.
The 18th century.
No, it would be the Gilded Age, the period between Reconstruction and World War I, which seems to be without incident, without history, really. So if you really, if you look at the textbooks, what do we have? It's the age of industrialization, the age of urbanization. You know. And there, quick, name some presidents. And people would have a very hard time naming that. So it's very possible that what we're talking about here is that there are long stretches of American history where these big processes do run the show, and the presidency doesn't matter. But it is also possible that that moment has ended and that the 20th century is so media-laden and we are so aware and we need so badly to tell ourselves a coherent story that we've lifted up the president. And it's not an
accident. We are so democratized, and we think, need one position
I think that's
that
the,
everybody
that's the
has
paradox.
Voted for and everybody has a stake in.
And everybody has an opinion about it.
Everyone has an opinion
right.
about it.
And a democratic age is an age of celebrity.
It is.
So it's a paradox because in a democracy we know, at least we're supposed to know, that every one of us, every voter,
we count. Counts.
We all count.
Even if our chads hang.
Well, then we don't count, do we? No.
But the point being here that we believe that a unquestioning focus on the personality doesn't get you very far in understanding much about American history,
right?
And we also believe that presidents are stepping into a moment of time, these larger currents, and what they're really trying to do is manage those in some ways. But we're not saying that who the president is does not matter.
Right. That's very okay? fair.
So what this suggests is that presidential transitions do matter, and that they have a large symbolic value rather than just the, okay, now the person who has my ideology is going to be able to come in and fix it.
But I think we're saying one more thing, Ed, or just to add one more thing, which is that we think it's a shame that so much national attention is focused on Obama and not what's going on in the laboratories, and not what's going on in Wall Street, not what's going on in the academy, not what's going on in the workplace, and not what's going on in our interactions with the rest of the world, which we think probably are going to explain change much more in the long run than just Barack Obama, even though the change to Barack Obama is clearly an important thing.
Yeah, I second that.
And I third it.
Well, good, because that's all the time we have for today. But if anyone out there disagrees with us...
As unlikely as that seems.
Well, even so, we want to know why. Drop in at our website and share your thoughts about today's show. The conversation continues 24/7 at backstoryradio.org.
Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson.
Jamal Milner is our post-production engineer, Gabby Alter wrote our theme, and Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory with the American History Guys is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation, Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, and an anonymous donor.
Support also comes from Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Claire Gargalli and David Carley, J.M. Weinberg, and Caroline Feeney.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayer is his President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.